So this evening is the second of two evenings about attachment. The first was a couple of weeks ago, which I thought was a very interesting evening. Raised a lot of issues. I got a lot of emails. That's one of the judges for me of like, well, was the talk fairly good and did it kind of stimulate things? Is the number of emails I get, and there were a lot. So this is going to be their shorter amount of time, and this is going to be a narrower focus. So this is attachment part two. I've entitled it, Maybe Attachment Isn't Such a Bad Thing. Because we normally think of attachment in Buddhist practice as being some kind of an obstacle or a deterrent or something to be really careful with. And it is to all of those things. And understanding that we're filled with attachments. And many of them are really positive if we know how to use them, is an important part of practice and certainly part of a mature practice. So I want to start with just a very simple little quotation from Ludwig Wittgenstein, who was an Australian-born British philosopher, and specialized in logic, the philosophy of mathematics, and the philosophy of language. A big brain and a big influential thinker in Western intellectual history. And he said something that is just, the Buddha could have said it. And he said, what is most important is hidden from us by its simplicity and its familiarity. Okay, what is hidden from us is because of its simplicity and familiarity. And this is certainly the human dilemma. If we can't see something, well, it's in operation, it's influencing us, but we're not working with it, and we're not seeing its influence. So that's great if it's something positive, and it's not so great if it isn't. And it's certainly the dilemma from a Buddhist perspective of attachment, because it is precisely because attachment causes a familiarity, because it becomes a habit. It becomes a mental formation, a deep habit of mind. And because it is a habit, we don't even see it. And it leads to a lot of suffering, and it leads to us harming ourselves and harming others. So I want to talk a little bit tonight about positive attachments, and then positive attachments having the potential to become not helpful or even negative. Okay. So I think all of us go through a stage, and maybe it's a lifelong stage, if you're interested in this kind of practice, where we want to be a good meditator, whatever that means, whatever a good meditator means. But certainly in this tradition, it has a number of very clear markers. It has to do with the ability to stabilize the mind and concentrate the mind so that we can willfully direct our attention, focus our attention in a particular way, and then be mindful about whatever we're experiencing. And it certainly has to do with actually knowing what we're experiencing. This is the critical element of knowing and being able just to discern the difference between different experiences and see into their very nature what causes them to arise, an emotion, a thought, a sensation in the body. So, any good meditation practice needs to have a certain number of elements that are hardwired into it, and these certainly are some of them, and the knowledge piece is a very big one. So what could happen is that we start off and we say, we really want to be a good meditator, and we read books about meditation, and we devote a lot of effort to it. come to this, we do one-day retreats, we go on residential retreats. And all of this to the end of like perfecting our meditation skills. And somewhere along the line, something starts to happen with the why of why we're doing this. And so, you know, the principal why has to do with this issue of knowledge. And Jay Krishnamurti, who I quoted in my last talk, who, you know, was really just a phenomenal teacher, and he wasn't a Buddhist, but so much of his teachings are completely consistent. And so Krishnamurti said, to transform the world, we must begin with ourselves, and what is important in beginning with ourselves is our intention. The intention must be to understand ourselves, not to leave it to others to transform themselves. This is our responsibility, yours and mine, because however small may be the world we live in, if we can bring about a radically different viewpoint in our daily existence, then perhaps we shall affect the world at large. And we know from at least the standpoint of Buddhist psychology that everything begins with our intention, so this intention to know. So you'll see this happen, and I'm including myself in this, is you'll go through periods or you kind of get lost for a much longer period, you know, that can be years, where if you were really looking at your sitting practice or if you were working with someone and they were querying you and working you through it, you would realize that the motivation had changed from primarily being knowledge, this experiential form of knowledge that leads to insight. That's the linkage. That's the reason the knowing quality is so important. When that is the principle, then we're willing to put up with and learn how to deal with all kinds of other things. You know, difficulties, uncomfortableness, being really, really challenged, being disoriented and confused. All of those things come along with a practice which is, that is the primary bedrock of it. Okay? And so what happens sometimes, and as I say, I'm including myself in this, is I'll sit down, I'll look at my practice, and I'll realize that I've actually backed off of that very high bar. And what I'm kind of going for are sittings that feel good or are comfortable, that make me feel good, and that I really don't want to be challenged that much in sitting. I just want to have a refuge and get away from it. And as long as I'm doing that, or we're doing that, or you're doing that, and we know it, and we've decided to do that perhaps because of the transitional stage we're going through and the conditions in our life, yeah, that's fine, right? I mean, this is part of a mature practice, recognizing what is it that I need to stay in practice, to stay in balance, to stay committed. And sometimes what we have to do is back off. And we have to take care of ourselves, heal ourselves. But if we don't know that, and of course this is the problem, and this is, I think, happens a lot, is that you've backed off, suddenly you're practicing in this way, and so the whole fundamental reason for being there, insight, wisdom, which supports compassion, stops happening. Because having a whole series of sittings that are really comfortable and relaxing and pleasant doesn't take you there. So that would be an illustration, you know, like I get really, as an aspiration and then an attachment, a healthy attachment, to being a really good meditator, and the purpose of that, one of the purposes of being able to know the experience that I'm experiencing and how that relates to causation, shifts into something else. Okay? And you don't see it. You don't even see that it's happening. So historically, I'm just going to highlight this real quickly because we talked about it the other night. In both Sanskrit and Pali, the idea of Sanskrit, the root word, has to do with clinging or holding on, attaching to. Okay? And that's an energetic quality that we can feel in the body. And then it manifests itself in all kinds of emotional states. But when we're really attached to something and we're holding on, it's important to understand that why did the Buddha make such a big thing out of this, out of attachment? And the reason is that attachment is part of the spectrum of experience that moves you into identification, which makes everything personal. So what's immediately before or simultaneously with the arising of attachment is desire or aversion. That's what's driving the holding on or the clinging. The holding on and the clinging, after a period of time or its intensity, turns into identification and personalization of experience. So you can, if you look for it and develop the ability and cultivate this, you can feel this in your body. It's crystal clear. And then the outward expressions of it are quite clear, because as the mind is holding on to something, it wants to defend it. So I get defensive about a position that I'm taking because I'm attached to the position. That the attachment helps make it personal. And I'm not using that word in a positive way. Okay. So traditionally, there's four. One is basically worldly things, you know, objects, persons, possessions, and experiences. So we can be attached to, and usually we see this in other people and don't see it in ourselves. We could be attached to having drama in our life, you know, or we could be attached to a chaos. Instability. So the mind can attach to anything for all different kinds of reasons, but those would be in the category of worldly things. The second is wrong view. Historically, that was about a very specific set of worldviews, but more generally, and for our purposes, it has to do with a view, an opinion, a belief, a perspective, a framework that confuses the mind and points it in the wrong direction. So it points it into suffering and doesn't understand that that's what it's doing. It actually thinks that this is going to lead me to happiness or lead me to balance. And because there's something that's not being seen, the attachment, it takes the mind someplace else. It takes the mind into suffering. Okay, and then you struggle for years and can't figure out why you're struggling. Why can't I deal with this? You know, and then the fascinating thing about insight is that once that insight presents itself, it is so clear and obvious you wonder how you couldn't have seen it before. You know, but it's not obvious at all at the time because of the attachment. The third was rites, rites and rituals, which was. arose out of the predominant religion of the day, which the only way that you could become liberated was if a series of priests, Brahmins, did certain rites or rituals in secret that you didn't get to see and you did not get to participate in. So, more generally, it refers to any rite or ritual, and that would include the way we practice, the framework of our practice, the rituals that we use in it, that are empty of this knowing quality. And so, I mean, you know, we could chant, and we could do that to concentrate the mind. And then there are chants that are actually designed to liberate the mind. Well, those two things feel differently. So you could be chanting to liberate the mind. What you're actually doing is just concentrating and soothing the mind. Okay. So once again, it's this knowing quality. You take that knowing quality out, the quality that leads to insight, and insight leads to liberation, then you have a rite or ritual which is hollow. It is empty of the core value of the practice. And then the final one is this self-referential, self-centeredness, a constant identification with self in relating to the world around us, which in the end always is at the root of our suffering. So I'm going to address just really briefly to underscore a couple of things, why attachment can potentially be problematic, and then talk about how to do it in, I think, a skillful way. So, the first point is that, in fact, attachment can be a very healthy thing if we know it, if we know that we're attached and we're working with it. If the value of attention in both a positive way and a negative way is that when we are attached to something, it influences what we pay attention to, how we pay attention to it, and why we pay attention to it. Now, if we're doing that intentionally, you know, I know that I'm attached to a particular form of practice, and I believe, and, you know, and I'm working with this, but I become attached to that because I believe that it leads to these things, and that directs my attention, it focuses my attention, and I approach it from a particular perspective, in part because of this aspiration attachment. Okay, so very, very positive and healthy. On the reverse side, if I'm doing that and I don't know it, it is potentially very, from a practice standpoint, unhealthy, because I'm doing something and there is no awareness looking at where is that pointing in the mind. So that, I can practice for months, for years, doing something in a completely unbalanced way, or I become unbalanced because my mind is focusing off of this mental formation or this attachment. So when this is happening, the negative part of it, if it's happening that way, in addition to, you know, pointing our mind in a particular place that isn't coming from a place of knowing, it's distracting our attention away from what we need to be paying attention to and what we need to be focusing on. And we don't know that's happened. But the way it might happen is, let's say that, going back to the good meditator idea. I want to be a good meditator, and so I'm putting a lot of effort into this. You know, I'm reading books about meditation. I'm taking courses that are heavily focusing on meditation. I'm going on retreats and what have you. And what my mind and my attention and my mindfulness is being distracted away from is the value of having a balanced practice which leads me to being a fully human person that has a dharmic skill set that allows me to take all of this into my everyday life. But that my mind either devalues that because I'm so committed to being a good meditator, you know, or that I don't see it at all. And my guess is that maybe everybody in this room has known a really good meditator who is basically a hot house plant. I mean, they really were, you know. I mean, like, you can really become a powerful meditator doing concentration practices and then not doing any insight work. and actually become more sensitive to the experiences of everyday life, become less skillful. So, you know, the whole purpose of this practice is to wake us up to the causes of our suffering and help us to heal from them. And key to that is having this balance of what we're doing. You know, not just meditation, but, you know, the Brahma Viharas and the Paramis and developing all of these things that support each other and support the arising of insight and the arising of compassion. So another way that I like to think of this devaluing element is, and once again, I'm really including myself in this because I've been, frankly, kind of dealing with this in the last several years in seeing that I wasn't seeing certain things. And when you don't see them or you devalue them, what you begin to do is you begin to neglect things that you ought not neglect. There are things that you ought to be paying attention to and caring for, and you start not doing that, or you start doing it in a diminished way. And it just doesn't take very long for that to create a problem, to come back and haunt you. So there are lots of positive attachments, and in the end what we need to do is have a positive attachment, but then transcend it. You know, in the Buddha's analogy of there's one shore, you know, this shore of suffering, and you get in the boat and it takes you to the other shore and you leave the boat there, right? It's like, you know, pick the boat up and carry it with you to wherever the other places you're going. Okay, so all of these things have a role and they have a value, and they become intuitive and instinctual rather than an attachment or a desire or aversion driven state of mind. So how could we do this skillfully? And this is where I'd like to read this from Barack Obama. Barack Hussein Obama. And I've been going back over his speeches. A couple of really fantastic books have come out, which are compilations of his speeches and about his speeches and how they were created and the team that he used to help him. It's fascinating. And particularly now you go back and look at these and the eloquence and the beauty and the clarity of the language and the ideas are striking. But this one, I think has to do with our topic, and so it's entitled "Hope Is." So, hope is not blind optimism. It's not ignoring the enormity of the task ahead or the roadblocks that stand in our path. It's not sitting on the sidelines or shirking from a fight. Hope is that thing inside us that insists, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that something better awaits us if we have the courage to reach for it, to work for it, and to fight for it. If we have the courage to reach for it, to work for it, and to fight for it. Hope is the belief that destiny will not be written for us, but by us, by all those men and women who are not content to settle for the world as it is, who have the courage to remake the world as it should be. Uh, So I actually think that the message here is quite a heady, powerful message. It's an exciting message about what may be possible. And where we frequently get in trouble with attachments is with ideas and beliefs, because those lead to expectations. So in this case, this is really powerful stuff about that there is something better awaiting us if we're willing to do certain things. And having something to do with creating or contributing to creating a world as it ought to be. So behind that, you can hear that there are assumptions and beliefs. And to reach for it, to work for it, and to fight for it, you would have to become attached in a healthy way to do that. If you weren't, you wouldn't be able to sustain this kind of effort. So I think that there is peril, and we've seen it repeatedly in Joanna Macy, the Buddhist scholar and teacher. All of her work has been around the idea that people get attached to making something happen that ought to be happening, and then burn themselves out and cause themselves enormous suffering because it isn't happening, or it's not happening quick enough, or it's not going to happen. And so she's been doing workshops for 30 years. It started with nuclear power. She went all over the world. And all these workshops are around activism. And they have to do with wanting something, being attached to it, and then burning out around it. So it's important, and this for me is the most important part of the talk, it's important to realize the Buddha did not say, don't get attached. He didn't say that. He said, if you get attached, know that you're attached. Understand the consequences, which way it's taking your mind, and make an informed choice, from a Buddhist perspective, all these tools, an informed choice about what we do with it. Because the wisdom piece of attachment is to hold on to whatever it is as long as it serves us, and then to let it go when it's not serving us and we don't need it anymore or it's hurting us. So that requires that we be awake, right? So that we are attached, we know we're attached, we understand the value of it, and we understand the potential dangers, and we're constantly reevaluating, and we'll hold on as long as it serves us in a healthy way, and we'll let go when it's not. So I thought about, who said that? That particular way, like what would be the formula? Joseph Goldstein or somebody, that I could end the talk with a big bang. and I couldn't find it. But then what came to me this afternoon was I've gotten a table in my kitchen that is basically identical to the table that was in the kitchen that I grew up with. It's one of those laminate tables, and it's kind of like if you go to Johnny Rockets or something, it's kind of that kind of thing. So I was able to find a place in St. Louis, and this is what they do. And they have the same kind of chairs, it's the same Naga height, everything. So I ordered this, and I've got it in my kitchen, and I walked in, and it's fascinating because having that thing there triggers these memories. And there's no order to them at all, right? It's your state of mind, and you walk in, boom, So what there was a memory of was that when you would walk into our kitchen, my mother had two little plaques on the wall. And the first little plaque showed, it was, both of these were wood. The first little plaque was wood, a brown wood, and it showed a man on a horse. There was a quotation, you know, cut into it, and it said, "If wishes were horses, beggars could ride." Okay? If wishes were horses, beggars could ride. You know, like, which I, retrospectively, I think is quite brilliant. You know, just like this constant reminder. You know, just keep reflecting on what is it that you're wishing for and hoping for in your life, and is it realistic, you know? Because if not, you know, there's, if it's possible, you'll get the horse, and if not, you'll, you know, you'll get something that comes out of the horse, okay? but that's, that wasn't the thing that seemed relevant to hear. What seemed relevant to hear was what was next to it, and it was wood, and it was red, and it was the what's called the Serenity Prayer, okay? And so I started thinking about that, and one of the things that came to mind was, well, who wrote the Serenity Prayer? You know, because likely it wasn't Jesus, you know, and they're wrong. And it turns out that the person that it's attributed to is Reinhard Niebuhr, who was associated with the oldest and only completely independent monastery in the United States, Christian monastery in New York City. You know, and it's kind of the liberal bastion of Christianity, and it's been the birthplace of all these things like black theology and women's theology and all of these different, they all come out of this place. So that was important to me because, you know, the poem starts out, let me get it here, you know, the poem starts out, "God grant me the serenity," right, which is a little different than how we would normally start out a poem or, you know. And then I thought on his works, you know, and he certainly didn't believe in or was advocating like a clockwork God. You know, that there was this omnipotent father who was making decisions and punishing certain people. And other, it was much more amorphous and consistent with the types of rethinking of what God means since World War II. You know, more as that which is beyond the mystery that is beyond our ability to understand it in concepts and words. So I looked at this and I realized that I had only looked at the part that you always hear quoted, and there's a couple of other lines, so I want to read this because I actually think that the first five or six lines of this, if we took the word God out, or if we defined God as wisdom, you know, the God within us, the wisdom within us, that it could actually be called the equanimity prayer. Okay, so God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardships as the pathway to peace. So that little expansion of it, it feels really significant to me. And why I'm closing with this is I'm going back to the idea of holding on to something as long as it serves us, and then letting it go when it stops serving us. You know, like, well, how would we do that? And I think it's right here. You know, the first piece is you know, looking at the world, our life, everything we're doing, and accepting those things that we cannot change. You know, that's the part of the teaching is about seeing things clearly, right? And being flexible enough to work with them. Okay. Then the second part is the courage to change the things that I can. So that takes some real discernment, right? Because frequently where we get in trouble is that we want things to change. You know, like, or in the Obama home, you know, that we want to create things the way they ought to be. And only if I fought hard enough and I reached for it and I did these things, it would happen. And having the ability to recognize that in a particular instance in our own life or in our larger life as a community, that that's just not going to happen, or it's not going to happen now. And to keep acting as if it is going to happen is only going to cause you suffering. So then if that's the case, it takes you back to the first line, to accept the things I cannot change. And so the whole process, one way to look at a practice is just this process repeating itself over and over again. You know, looking, it's all causes and conditions. So there's certain things in my life, this is the way it is, I can't change them. They're not going to change. It appears there's a series of other things that I can do, that I can change, that I can change the conditions. And that's actually part of practice and pointing my mind towards wisdom and happiness. And so I start doing that, but I stay awake. And at some point I realize that some of that is wrong. But I'm not going to be able to change that. So then I accept that as it is, right? So it's a constant redefinition process, and insight is one of the things that reveals this to us. You know, we have these insights that I'm just causing myself to really, really suffer because I want something that I'm just not going to get. It's just not going to happen. Okay. So at that moment, it's like, okay, do I actually let go because it's not serving me anymore? Or do I continue to hold on? You know, sometimes we can have an initial insight to that and still hold on. And we hold on even though we know it's going to cause us suffering, because the attachment is so deep, there's a hope back there that despite everything, you know, I'm hoping that what I'm seeing isn't true. You know? So it's so tricky. It's so amazingly tricky. But I don't think, to kind of wrap this up, I think it's a mistake to think of all attachment as a negative, because it's not. I think it's important to realize that having really healthy aspirations and healthy attachments is not only healthy, it's actually part of the path. But the trick to that is knowing it, knowing that we're attached, understanding what the consequences are, and staying awake to the fact that I am attached and it's influencing me, and making an informed dharmic choice about what I should do. We do that, you know, it's really good practice and it'll take it someplace. But if we take any of those three, take them out, then we're going to be back to attachment being, attachment is a serious problem. Okay, so we've got a few minutes if there's questions or comments on this.
Could you include that
Well, you know, we could just put it up as an attachment to the talk. You know, we frequently will put up a handout, yeah. So we could do that.
Then we can print it out and put it up on our refrigerator.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm getting too hung up on words, but my question conceptually with what you're saying, at first it sounded almost anti-Buddhist, that, you know, there's good attachment as opposed to, you know, attachment causes suffering and we should get away from all attachment. But it seems like what you're describing, which is being aware of what it is you're participating in and bonded with, or whatever you want to call it, attached to. But then when it stops serving you to let go, that seems like a kind of a poetic way of saying you're not really attached to it. You're just aware of it and you're participating in it, but you're not unclean to it when it's not serving you.
Okay. So as a starting premise, I would agree with the idea that the complete end game, when we're fully cooked, is that we don't have any attachments. In the same way that the complete end game is that we have no identification. Okay? And I don't know about you, but I have a healthy reserve of whether or not I'm going to completely eliminate all attachment and all self-identification in this lifetime. I'm hoping that I will, but you know, I've got a very healthy suspicion about that. So we're talking about, in the interim, how do we be skillful to move towards that goal? Okay. So have you ever had an experience in your life where it's really clear to you that you're you know, really attached to something, and you're defensive about it, and if somebody raises it, you know, we see this in a family context all the time, and at some point you no longer have that attachment, but something happened, right? Okay, so it's not that there wasn't an attachment to begin with, it's that there was an attachment and then something happened for the attachment to lose its hold. Okay, so what I'm saying is that for like with, and the reason I chose this Obama poem is this notion about, well, there's something awaiting us that's better if only I'm willing to reach for it and to make the effort and to fight for, you know. I don't know how you could do that without being pretty attached to the notion that there is something waiting for me, and I'm willing to fight for it, not physically, but in the sense of putting in the effort and the struggle and everything else, you know, to sustain it. Okay. But then at some point, the nature of the attachment starts to change, so that at first, attachment is driven wholly by desire and aversion. So then in this instance, and let's say it were true, and you did this, and you started to actually recognize that there is something waiting for me, and isn't this the promise of Buddhist practice? That something is waiting for us if we become mindful and develop our compassion and our kindness and equanimity. There will be a different life, you know? So once part of this starts to unfold and reveal itself to us, the nature of our relationship to it changes. And so we start relating to it from a more equanimous place, because I have the confidence that the practice is actually what the Buddha said that it is, so that rather than it, like what's really happening is, I really want this badly, but I'm not totally sure that it's true, you know? And then you have these experiences, and it's like, no, this is true. So like in my own case right now, there's a lot of things in my, a lot of issues in my life that I'm not very skillful at, that I'm not competent at, that I hurt myself and I hurt other people. I'm very clear about that. That's not the problem with the teachings. That's because of where I am on the path. But I have so much confidence, based on the parts of my life that have been healed by this, that there is no question in my mind about the legitimacy of the teaching. The only time that I have a question is, I'm quite clear that it's my inability to understand it. But in all of those areas where it's transformed things, I don't have striving there anymore. You know, I'm relating to it with equanimity or compassion or other things, right? So then that changes the underlying nature of the attachment. You know, the hold on to it while it serves you, let it go. So it may be the way I'm wording it sounds a little too simple, right? But it's a developmental process. And at one point we can let go a little bit, and then, you know, like Ajahn Chah has this quotation, he says, you know, let go a little bit, you'll have a little bit of freedom. You know, let go a lot, you'll have a lot of freedom. Let go completely, you'll have complete freedom. Well, it's developmental, you know. Like at the beginning, when you take on a deep attachment, you just can't say, well, this mental formation that's just been tormenting me for years, I just let it go. You know, I can see it, I'm going to make an informed choice. You know, you're going to make a little choice, and then as you work with it, you're going to make a bigger one, and keep making them, and then sometimes they completely disappear, you know. Mm-hmm. So does that help?
Yeah.
Or not? Yes.
Can you speak to the relationship between connection and attachment?
Between?
Connection and attachment.
And by connection, you mean? I want to make sure that I answer the question that you're
thinking. My idea of connection, because when, I guess in one sense it seems like they're similar words, but in here, to me, they're very different. And the more that I sit and observe, the more I get connected. But I don't feel that attachment, but I'm not as evolved as other people in this, in Buddhism. So I was just curious if there was some kind of discussion about connection versus attachment, because to me, it's sometimes they're almost opposites.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So, well, let me give you an answer and see if this gets close to what you're thinking,
yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That word for me, you know, connectivity, right, has to do with relationship. So, the more we practice, the type and degree, intensity of relationships with the things we were talking about, with people, with certain kinds of experiences, with the natural world, with animals, all begins to change in a healthy, positive way. So in that sense, I wouldn't associate, you know, attachment with relationship. You could have an attached relationship, right? And you see this in certain kinds of couples all the time, right? I mean, you just the dysfunction is significant. So they certainly have a relationship, but there is an element of it that is, you know, holding on, clinging, binding them together in one element of it is unhealthy. So.
That's good.
Thank you. Okay, so I think that's it for tonight. Thank you very much for coming, and may our efforts to explore this thing. And before I want to thank you too again. Really, I'm just so thankful for you and what you represent. You know. So I'm really convinced, and my deepest wish is that our coming together like this and exploring these kinds of things ripples out into the world around us in the most positive way, and may it contribute to diminishing in some real way the suffering in the world, and contributing to in some real way the comfort of all beings and the happiness of all beings. So, thank you.